Would you like to be able to start conversations like a pro? Take the Sunday World, your daily dose of what's going on. Do not consume the Sunday World if you're involved in a drug cartel, you're a politician with something to hide, or you've appeared on a reality TV show and care about others' opinions. Consume the Sunday World responsibly. Always read the stories, gossip, and commentary.
Wow, buddy! You look healthy and happy.
Veterinary surgeon and natural pet food pioneer John Burns knows the positive impact a natural diet has on our beloved pets. That's why he developed Burns Pet Nutrition.
Maybe I should try some of your pet food myself. Okay. I'll start with a salad.
For natural, no nasty, wholesome recipes, choose Burns Pet Nutrition. Available from veterinary clinics and all good pet shops across Ireland.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
We're back on the road this April with our live show, Cocaine Cowboys. If you want to hear the story of Ireland's love affair with Colombian powder and those who made millions in the gold rush, limited availability remains in Belfast at ulsterhall.co.uk. That's ulsterhall.co.uk.
As like a 12, 13-year-old kid, he ran into this Crips house to buy a gun to protect himself. And the Crips basically laughed in his face, but they said, we'll protect you. So David got inducted pretty much like right away. And then for roughly 4 years, he was an active member of that gang. It took her dying for him to realise how disrespectful he was to his own mother and how she was really just trying to help him.
I'm Nicola Tallant, and you're listening to Crime World, a podcast about criminals, drugs and the sins of the underworld in Ireland and across the globe. Irish writer Cillian Dunn delved into the murky world of LA's underworld and its notorious Crips and Bloods mobs when he met a former gang member who wanted to tell his story. Today, Cillian tells me about his book, Dreams in Incarceration, and about the incredible life of David Spivey, jailed at 17 after turning to the Crips for protection in his South Central LA neighbourhood. This is Crime World, a podcast from SundayWorld.com. So, Cillian, we're going to start with a little bit of a potted history between you and I of the Crips and the Bloods. We're going to do our best. We're not claiming to be total experts on it. You have written a book, Dreams in Incarceration, with a former member of the Crips, and we'll come on to his story. But just before we do that, just to introduce to the listeners and the viewers who they are, and they go back really to the 50s and 60s in LA, to that Black Panther movement, to, I suppose, the civil rights, and they were trying to sort of move black people into what was white neighbourhoods. There was a lot of unrest in those days, and it created then what became this kind of street gang.
That's right. Yeah, they totally stemmed from those African-American movements of the 1950s and post-World War II. And then in the late 60s, the Crips were formed by actually two teenagers.
Right.
They were, I believe, 17 years old at the time, because street warfare, to my knowledge, street warfare in Los Angeles, but specifically said Central Los Angeles, was sort of running rampant. And these kids just sort of banded together to keep themselves safe, for lack of a better way to put it.
And so that there is a huge amount of social history in the background there for anybody who cares to read up more on it. But basically by the 70s, this gang, which had formed, had split into two factions. And I mean, like any sort of these feuds and splits and gangs, it seems to have started between two people with a kind of a general grudge against each other. There was a murder and people took sides. And those sides, first of all, became the Bloods and the Crips. They all looked alike. They seemed alike. They were once friends. But they sort of, to identify themselves, the Bloods would have worn
red and the Crips blue, and they became very sort of significantly different gangs, although they'd come from the same areas and they were ultimately doing the same thing, but they were warring factions from the 70s on.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, the Crips were blue and the Bloods were red. And then one interesting thing that I learned from my research and sort of from my interviews with David Spivey is that as time progressed, there was actually a lot of like internal conflict. So Bloods started to fight with Bloods and Crips started to fight with Crips, to the point where Bloods versus Crips, it's very much still a thing. And there's a lot of, there's a lot of the intensity over that sort of feud, but there's actually just as much intensity over internal conflict. And it's nowadays it's all sort of geographically based. So there's you can look it up online. There's a map of Los Angeles and it has little pockets of red and blue all over the city. And it shows you which neighborhoods and territories are ran by which crew. But within those blue, there's like different shades of blue for like different kinds of Crips. And within the red, there are different shades of red for different kinds of Bloods. And they're essentially all feuding with one another. So,
right,
you know, nowadays it barely even matters whether you're a Blood or a Crip. It sort of matters about your geography.
And I suppose then, going back in time a little bit before we concentrate on David Spivey, the 80s, the crack epidemic started. They were obviously involved in drug dealing. They began to branch out outside LA and kind of taking drug territories in other cities. In the 90s, the Bloods and Crips sort of became a culture. It was part of the whole rap music scene. And I often talk to a journalist called Douglas Century in regard to all that, all these various rows that happened within the rap scene and people choosing to, go red or go blue, and all of that sort of happened. But it's become cultural. I think there's a difference between a street gang and when that has happened over a couple of decades, that's really seeped into the culture. So by the 2000s, when David Spivey is coming of age, he's a young man. The gang activity is on the rise. I imagine if it's anything like here, it's because it goes with the economy, doesn't it? So as economies rise, there's more drugs bought and taken and more gang activity, more people trying to enter the market to make a quick buck. And obviously that results then in paranoia and various feuding. So let's start there. And David is 17 years old, is he, in 2003 or 2004? Maybe tell me a little bit about his background, where he came from.
Yeah, so David's from a place called Inglewood. Here, it's a pretty big sort of like neighborhood suburb part of LA. It's sort of famous for its gang activity, for lack of a better way to put it. You know, it's a really big region of land, but within Inglewood there are multiple different gangs, and they're all feuding with each other. So David actually has. I found it quite sad when he told me he grew up with basically without a father in the house. He had a mom and a little brother. And when he was about 12 or 13 years old, he actually hadn't joined a gang yet. A lot of his friends and people at school sort of had already. And he was a boxer. He was training one day. He was training to be a boxer in his local gym. And as he was leaving, these sort of like slightly older kids, maybe like 15, 16, he said, were agitating him and basically just sort of trying to start a fight with him and all that. And he told them off, and every day they would come back to that gym looking for him, until one day they got into a row outside the gym. David fought them and the guy went back to his car to get a gun. So David ran to the police station. I guess the sheriff was just right down the road, and he ran in and he told them what was going on, and the police didn't help him. The police basically told him to leave. They said they couldn't do it. And so David, being very afraid, knew about a Crip that lived on a street. He would have been like in his early 20s. He was a young man. And so out of desperation, he ran there. Told the guys that he was being chased by these gang members and that they were trying to kill him. and he wanted to buy a gun to protect himself. As like a 12, 13-year-old kid, he ran into this Crip's house to buy a gun to protect himself. And the Crips basically laughed in his face. These guys, they laughed in his face, but they said, you know, we like you, like we'll protect you. So David got inducted pretty much like right away. And then for roughly 4 years, he was an active member of that gang, and they gave him a nickname. His nickname was Baby Roscoe because he was the youngest.
So, in other words, the protection that he felt he really needed at that point in his life, and he got, came with a price, and the price was that he'd work for them.
Exactly. Yeah, it's really, you know, it sounds very sort of like traditional for any sort of gang. He was inducted in at a young age, essentially for protection, and then it just completely elevated over the course of 4 years. When, you know, and then at the age of 17, he got caught for murder. So everything just sort of escalated to that
point. And Killian, what about his mother there and the younger sibling? Like, how did the mother react to this? Him, I suppose, hanging with these new guys, and she would have known from her own neighbourhood who was part of a gang, who was in the Crips, who wasn't. So she obviously fairly quickly realised that her son had been drawn into this world.
Yep, David. So not to give any spoilers for the book, but David's mom tragically passed away while he was in prison. So I never got the chance to speak to her, but from what David told me, and David's very honest man, and very upfront about sort of everything that he has done and how he felt about us. But he said that his mom really, really, really actively tried to get him to sort of live a normal life and not join a gang. He did a lot of sort of extracurricular stuff, including the boxing. Mm. When he was a kid, she worked like three jobs just to support their family. She was always working, and David says, you know, for lack of a better way to put it, he was a little sort of rascal when he was a kid. Like even before he joined the gang, he would talk back to her. He said he was very disrespectful, and then when he joined the gang, he said that his ego was inflated greatly because, you know, you're a young kid, you're like, I guess, tracking back to that like 90s rap and sort of like how the Bloods and the Crips are represented in pop culture. Mm. You know, he grew up with that. Like he was a kid when that was like really getting popular. So he thought it was the coolest thing ever to be in a gang. His ego was inflated, and then and it was game over from there for his mom. She couldn't get through to him, and it basically took him years to realize it. It took her dying for him to realize how disrespectful he was to his own mother, and how she was really just trying to help him.
And how that was sort of, you know, brought along, I suppose, by that new identity he'd found, which is something that most kids of that age, teenagers, are looking for, some identity, aren't they? And obviously, you know, if you're growing up in an area like that in LA, surrounded by these gangs, that's probably the primary, you know, relatable identity. And, you know, you become part of something, I think, when kids enter those gangs. It's interesting to find somebody who is able to reflect back and articulately express exactly what's going on with them at this point, because it's a point where they really are being groomed and being used by these gangs. And he's able to see that. I suppose he was a teenager anyway. He was probably going to be, you know, a little bit disrespectful to his mum anyway, but he's getting a confidence in doing that out of his membership or his acceptance into the gang. So she obviously is trying to keep him on the straight and narrow as much as she can. I'm sure her biggest dread was one of two things: either that he was going to get shot dead or that he was going to end up in prison. So by the age of 17, her worst fears come through. So tell us what happened then.
In a nutshell, essentially, David's 17 years old when you're a teenager in these gangs, and this goes for just about any violent gang in the US. It's not just Crips and Bloods and things like that. You know, there are so many of them. But when you're a teenager, you are, for them, you're in a sort of beneficial position. You can be used as like a drug runner. You can be used as a hitman. You know, you can essentially do anything when you're a kid because people don't really think that kids are capable of doing these things. So David was put into a lot of like really terrible positions by the upper members of his gang, but going side, you know, going in tandem with that was his rising ego. And, you know, he knew exactly what he was doing and he was fine with it. Then he, one day these two rival gang members, they rolled through his neighborhood in their car, and David and his peers were essentially told to go after them and hunt them down. So they did just that. They hunted them down. And I use that word hunt very, very literally. They hunted them down. Like, you know, it was vicious. It was malicious. And they, And then they did a drive by on this, this like very small motel in Inglewood, and they killed one of them. There were two of them. They killed one of them. One of them survived with gunshot wounds. And then they got caught right down the block. A cop was really close by. Heard the gunshots. They got caught very quickly. And then, yeah. And then David was, you know, he was tried as an adult. And I believe, I'm actually not too sure how long that trial truly lasted, because I know David did fight us initially. He was a minor, and he and his lawyer did fight us, but he was tried as an adult, and he found himself in California State Prison, which is federal prison, some of the worst in the entire country, and some of the most overcrowded too. And he found himself there as a teenager. Mm. So he quickly found himself in
prison. And what sentence did he get?
He got 100 years to life. So his first sentence was 100 years to life, which is essentially just a life sentence. Like, you know, nobody's living to be 117. Yeah. So he got 100 years to life. And then over the course of a couple of years, that was actually commuted down. So that was then brought down to 65 to life. I believe his lawyer on the outside was still fighting for him, and they managed to get that down to 65. And then from there, over, you know, the course of X many years, it was sort of like chipping away at a block. But he eventually got a sentence commuted down from 100 to 67 down to 15 years to life. And the governor of California actually had to sign off on that at the time. So he got very lucky.
And did he discuss with you over the course of your interviews? Of course, you know, David is 34 now, and he's living a life that he's sort of giving back a little bit, maybe, to that society that spat him out. He's a mental health professional. He's operating in South Central LA, and he's, you know, working as well as a motivational speaker. He has come sort of full circle, and from reading your book, he feels remorse for what he's done. He's not denying his role in that. He certainly feels for certainly the mothers of his two victims. He very much understands how they view him. But I think he's got a great understanding as well of what happened to him and how, you know, it all went wrong for him as such. So you met up with David when you were working in a pub.
I was the bar manager of like an event. So it was basically just a New Year's Eve event that my friend and I were throwing here in LA, and we hired David as a security guard. We didn't know anything about his background, but he worked for this security company that we had a connection with. So nobody came to the event. It was a total dud. And I ended up talking to him for about 3 or 4 hours, just about nothing, just joking around. And then I followed him on Instagram, and I think a few weeks later he had posted a tell-all video of him on Instagram, like an hour-long video explaining what he had done and how he had felt about it. So I had just finished writing another sort of like an investigative book, it's technically a narrative nonfiction book, and I was looking for another one. So I called him and just said, "Hey, would you be open to talking about this?" So just sort of, yeah, it was all sort of like independently motivated by me. I was really taken by his story right away. And then I started going to see him, and we would do phone calls sometimes, or sometimes I would go down to South Central and interview him. And then, you know, he would get calls from prison, or he would call his friends in prison, and we would speak to them over the phone. And some of them were going through like their parole process, so I was able to learn a little bit about the parole process and things of that nature. So it was very organic. It sort of, it sort of came out of nowhere, basically, for lack of a better way to put it. Yeah, it came out of nowhere.
And was it hard for you to equate the guy in front of you now with the, you know, the guy who, did he talk to you about exactly what role he took in the shooting?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. He pulled the trigger. Yeah, he held the gun. He pulled the trigger. He's totally guilty. And he did. Yeah, it was a bit difficult to sort of like pair those two people up alongside each other. But that being said, like David is so eloquent, and like he's got such a way with words that I could really visualize exactly the kind of person that he was when he committed these crimes, and even while he was in prison. You know, it wasn't as if he murdered this gang member and, you know, immediately felt remorse. Like he went to prison and he had a name for himself. Like he had a reputation. People knew exactly who he was. He was violent. Yeah, he was really violent. So to see where he is now compared to the stories that he tells, and also his friends, essentially, it's pretty inspiring. It's pretty amazing, and that's why I felt I really just felt super motivated to write a story, because I think it's incredible.
You have done something that's quite difficult in writing terms, in that you've done it in his voice. Which is quite difficult to find another person's voice when you're writing. But so tell us about that, when he's, you know, handed down initially, I suppose, that 100-year-to-life sentence. Is his mother standing there looking at this playing out? How does he feel going into jail? Is there any sense of, does he really understand the finality of that? Or does he go in as this hard guy trying to make a new name for himself within the prison system?
No, you're dead on. He totally goes in as a hard man. He doesn't care. He doesn't really care. His mom she's there on the sideline, and she's there for him, and she visits him regularly, especially in, you know, the sort of like last years of her life while he's in prison. But he does not care about his situation until she dies. It's very, to me, it was a very interesting mindset, because I know like Irish, any prison will be very similar, but in the US, there are just so many races and so much like deep-rooted history between the races that prison is segregated, and there's no way that prison would work in the US. It just wouldn't work any other way than the way it does right now. And it sounds quite animalistic to say that like everything's segregated, but like the way I sort of like use the metaphor of the plains of Africa, or like the Serengeti. It's like you have like your different kind of animals like spread out all across the yard, all across the plains, and they're all constantly just looking to kill each other. Mm. Like they are constantly looking to kill each other. So David goes from the streets, which is a hostile environment, into a federal prison, like a level 4 prison, level 3, level 4, which is essentially where they harbor like all of the murderers and the rapists and just all the worst people and all the gang members. And he is fighting for his life like right away, from the second he wakes up at like 4 a.m. or half 4 in the morning to the second he goes to sleep. He is he's on guard. He's ready to fight for his life. So he doesn't feel remorse. He feels bad that he got caught. He feels that he has to be like the king of the jungle, but at the same time, he still has to follow orders, because these factions, these gangs in prison, they're a tight operation. You know, they have to wake up at a certain, it's like being in the military. They have to wake up at a certain time. They have to go to bed at a certain time. They have to congregate in very specific areas of the yard. They get tasks, like whether it be, you know, you have to bring heroin to this guy, or you have to like get your mom to like sneak in a $50 Starbucks gift card. Like really, really, like really crazy stuff overall. But he just does not have time to feel remorse until he realizes that, you know, when his own mom dies, for context, his mom dies, and then a month later, his younger brother is murdered in a gang altercation. So the two things basically happened at once. And that's when David really realized that, you know, his actions truly did have consequences because he had murdered somebody's son that was feeling the same way that he was now.
Mm.
So, yeah, it's tragic.
A horrendous life. And what age was he at that point?
He was in his mid-20s. Yeah, he was like basically like my age. I'm 28. He was like 27.
So he was 10 years incarcerated at that point. So he had been 10 years living on the gang life as such within the four walls of a prison, but still that same belief in you're fighting for survival against an enemy. And like, he must have been really hardened at that stage. I mean, as you're telling the story, I could just think of the 12-year-old boy, obviously from a loving home and a stable home, and the mother providing as well as she can for them. And he's at his extracurricular activity, the boxing, which is, she's obviously paying for that out of her earnings. And all of a sudden he's lost. He's standing in front of her in a courtroom at 17, getting sentenced to that kind of an amount of time. She's obviously not given up on him, but he himself must be so hardened by the age of 27 when she dies. What is it in him that then makes the decision to change his life around and for the better?
It really was. So his mom died of lupus. And the way that he said it clicked for him was that he says that he killed his mom. He said that he killed his mom, that it was the stress of him and his younger brother being active gang members, him being incarcerated, his younger brother being out on the streets doing the same thing that he was. He said, he claims that it was him that drove his mom to the grave. That obviously is more than likely an exaggeration and something that, like, psychologically he just sort of, like, he just attributes to...
He believes that, so...
So, yeah, exactly. So he believes it, and then that was sort of like a snap thing. Like he quotes this all the time. I think he said it was like he says Jay-Z who said it, but he said, if I had been a lawyer, my little brother would have been a lawyer, but I wasn't. I was a gang member, so my little brother was a gang member. So his brother was murdered, the same way that David had murdered somebody else's son or brother, and so when those two things happened literally within a month of each other. David knew that he essentially didn't want to die in prison, and he didn't want to like let his mom down from above. He's very religious and like spiritual, and he found that in prison. But he essentially just didn't want to didn't want his mom and his brother to die in vain. So he began the process of disassociating from his gang while in prison, which is just about the most dangerous thing you can do, because, like I said earlier, about like the Serengeti and the African plains, it's like, you know, think about it. Like if you're like a pack of lions and you're all together, like nobody's going to mess with you. But if one lion steps off from the pack, it just makes you vulnerable. So that's how David was. He started to slowly step away from the pack. So he was in a vulnerable state, but it was a necessary action for him to do, because otherwise the parole board would never let an active gang member back out on the street. So,
and did the prison service help him with that journey to try and pull away from the gang?
They do, yeah. So David essentially was in like seven prisons overall. You're in California, I'm not sure if it's like a federal thing, but in California, you're able to transfer prisons after like a year and a half, 2 years. So David was able to sort of bounce around. If things got too bad or intense in one prison, he could transfer to a different place and sort of start over. Now, that being said, there are like sort of shock collars for each gang, and one shock collar might be in a prison like in like Folsom State Prison or something in Northern California, but they could be calling the shots for a prison down in Southern California, like near the Mexican border, like a solid 10-hour drive. So, you know, David couldn't like 100% escape it, but he would, in different prisons, he would have different roles. So one of his roles in, I believe, Pelican Bay State Prison, which is really, that's a level 4 prison. That's like a very, very dangerous prison up in Northern California. He started working at the local chapel, so that when people were out in the yards, in the yard amongst the general population, David was inside the chapel, because in the yard, that's where like a lot of race riots break out. And if a race riot breaks out, then you are required to fight. So no matter what, like no matter who you are, what you do, or how big you are, whatever, like if a race riot breaks out, you have to fight. So David had to physically separate himself from those people and from the yard without sort of letting on that that's what he was doing. And then of course there are like classes that you can take in prison. The California state prison system, it's getting better, and they're trying to I know this because I actually spoke with a lot of prison wardens in my research. Specifically the warden of San Quentin prison told me this, that a lot of these prisons are modeling themselves off the Norwegian prison system. So they're trying to like treat their inmates a lot better and give them a little bit more freedoms so that they can like mend under a structure that doesn't like promote violence or segregation as much as it currently does.
Mm. It's very dramatically described the day of his parole hearing, and he comes face to face with the two victims' mothers who are still alive. And he's finally basically told that I think he does another 120 days and he's free to get out, and he does. Now, how does he manage when he gets out to kind of keep away from what got him in trouble in the first place? Because I'm presuming that he goes back to the neighborhood where he grew up.
Yeah, that's it. It's a great question. I still think about that sometimes myself. Now, David, yeah, he spent 15 years in prison. And like as much as that is a lot of time, it's also not. You know, I've asked him a lot. I've also asked him about, the person that he murdered and the person that he attempted to murder, like their families, and you know, what, like if they have any active gang members like that are coming after him, like things like that. And to my knowledge and to his knowledge, there is nothing. So David gets out of prison and he of course knows some active gang members, and you know, he's in many ways, people are trying to drag him back into that life. David just sort of stayed firm and said, he uses this, what it's sort of a trick or whatever, like a little thing that he does, but if somebody from his past that is involved in that life wants to meet up with him, or especially right when he got out of prison, if they wanted to meet up with him, he told them to meet him at the gym. And if they showed up to the gym to work out with him, he'd give them a second chance and he could try, you know, kind of connect with them as a normal person and not as a gang member. But if they didn't show up to the gym, David knew that it wasn't worth his time. So he said he did that for everybody who reached out to him. He did that for all of them. And only one guy showed up, and he's still friends with that guy. And they're both former gang members. They both disassociated, but the ones that didn't show up, they're still sort of bang banging and doing their thing. So David literally just physically separated himself from all of these people in his past. And he works a lot. Like he works 6 days a week, 7 days a week sometimes. He doesn't really have, he's just making sure he doesn't have time to ever fall back into that stuff.
And he's still working on I suppose, being a valued member of society. And what about you, Killian? You're from a very different background than he is. You must have learned a lot from this experience and from doing this book.
I did. I learned loads. I'm from Dublin. I'm from Finglas. And I've lived in the US now for about 9 years. Overall, I lived in Boston for 5, and I've been in LA for 3.5, nearly 4 years now. So I said to David, like from the very first interview, I was like, Jesus, you know, like I'm probably not the right guy to write your story. Like I'm from 6,000 miles away. I'm white. I'm from a very I'm from a very different place. And he was cool with it. You know, we just got on really well with each other. And when I'm writing stuff, I like you said, I write in the first person. My interest is the psychology behind it. So I wanted to know how somebody could do something so horrible and turn out good on the other side. And with David, it really was just awareness. And I just tried to boil it down to like the simplest emotions or like the simplest things. So with David, it was really just like self-awareness was the biggest thing. So while I was writing David as a character, I made him very self-aware of his actions and his surroundings. That way, the audience was sort of like trailed along through this story, and like at various milestones in his prison career, we understand how he's feeling and why he's feeling the way that he does. So that when he does start to want to turn his life around, we know exactly why and sort of like what to expect.
Yeah, I mean, look, as a writer of this sort of stuff, we don't have a place within this story. It's his story, and it's just really helping him to tell the narrative in a way that doesn't leave any unanswered questions at the end of it for the reader. Like exactly delving into people's emotions, how they were feeling at a particular time, and, you know, helping them tell their story. So what's next for you on the agenda?
Yeah, I have, I can't talk too much about it, but I have a book. I'm writing a book right now. And it's actually a Panamanian story. So I spent the entire month of October in Panama conducting interviews and doing research all around the country with regards to, I'm sure you're aware, they had like dictators from 1968 to 1989, the most prominent being Manuel Noriega. So I am conducting a lot of interviews and research down there. I'm actually going back to Panama in 5 days, 4 or 5 days. So I'm leaving on Sunday. And
what is your background, Killian? Did you study here or did you study in the US?
I went to like secondary school and all that in Dublin, and I got recruited or like scouted to play soccer at a college in the US. So I went to college in Boston at a college called Northeastern University. That being said, I'm also a dual citizen of the US. My brother and I were born in the US, and then my parents just kind of, we got the citizenship, and a few years after that, my parents brought us back to Dublin. But we sort of always had this connection to the US. We would come over here every summer. So there is a bit of a US-Irish connection with our family there. But I'd say after 18 years old, I've lived here for 10 years. So it's been a while since I've lived in Dublin.
Yeah. And what did you study?
I studied marketing. I'm pretty much self-taught and independently motivated for all of this stuff. It's really just a general interest, but I started doing this. I started doing these like narrative nonfiction, like sort of investigative books during COVID. I had just published my first book. It was the second book I'd ever written, but it was my first published book. And there basically was this woman who my mom knew from Boston, who she, if you're familiar with like the Spotlight team at the Boston Globe, they made that movie. Yeah. So this woman was married to a headmaster of a very prestigious boarding school for over 30 years. And one day the FBI came knocking on her door and they told her that her husband, the headmaster, was being accused of sexually assaulting his students at the boarding school. So these investigators wanted the wife to work with them against her husband without him knowing. So she had to become like a spy within her own home. And it was sort of like a domestic espionage thriller sort of thing. And I wrote that and I interviewed that woman for a month and I wrote that book in the first person. So I had to get inside of the mind of essentially like a wife who was constantly being gaslit and who was coming to terms with the fact that her husband may or may not have done these things. So I wrote that book and the reception was pretty good. And I just became like obsessed with the whole sort of process. And then I just went out and did the whole David Spivey Dreams and Incarceration thing, just 100% independently motivated by myself. I quit my job. I quit like my job. I had no income whatsoever for the entire time writing this. And I just love it. Basically just saying I'm obsessed and I absolutely love doing this stuff.
I mean, there's lots of people out there who need help, who don't have the same sort of skills that maybe writers have, and they need help to get their story down and kind of into a way that can be understood by other people. So tell me where people can buy Dreams and Incarceration.
Right now, it can only be bought on Amazon, but it's $10. I'm actually Not too sure what that equates to in euro. Just
probably about the same at the moment, I believe, as I head to the States shortly. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, about 10 euro then on Amazon. And it's also available on Kindle as well. So if you're a Kindle Unlimited member, you can actually read it for free. Otherwise, you can buy it for about 5 euro on Kindle as well.
Right. Well, listen, we'll talk again, I think. I mean, I like the idea of that that first story you wrote. Maybe we can come back to that someday, have a chat about that, and keep in touch about your Panamanian investigation. Okay, Killian, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Nicola. Appreciate it.
You've been listening to Crime World, a podcast from SundayWorld.com. Produced by Ian Mullaney and edited by me, Nicola Tallant. Research assistant is Clodagh Meaney. If you like this show and love true crime, leave us a review. Or why not download the free SundayWorld.com app for lots more stories from Ireland and across the globe.
Would you like to be able to start conversations like a pro? Take the Sunday World, your daily dose of what's going on. Do not consume the Sunday World if you're involved in a drug cartel, you're a politician with something to hide, or you've appeared on a reality TV show and care about others' opinions. Consume the Sunday World responsibly. Always read the stories, gossip, and commentary.